The Science of Great UI and Software with Mark Miller.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host, for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and to run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. The podcast is sponsored by ClearMeasure, a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. They are hiring architects and .NET engineers who would like a path to become an architect. You can go to clearmeasure.com/careers for that. And if you have a comment or question for the show, send me an email at podcast@palermo.network. And that's palermo.network. And also, my new online TV show has launched, Programming with Palermo. And you can search for that in any podcast directory or on YouTube. And you can also find it at www.palermo.network. And we're up to episode number 11. So that's exciting. Today's guest is Mark Miller. He is a 7-time C-Sharp MVP with strong expertise in decoupled design, plug-in architectures, and great user interfaces. He's the chief architect of the IDE Tools division at Developer Express, as well as the visionary force behind productivity tools like CodeRush. Mark is a top-ranked speaker at conferences around the world and has been creating tools for software for almost 4 decades, or probably over 4 decades. And on top of all that, Mark also streams live C-Sharp and TypeScript coding and design on twitch.tv/CodeRushed. That's CodeRush ED, past tense. Mark, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing pretty good, pretty good. There's a lot to catch up on. There's a lot of listeners who probably did not catch your previous episode, but have probably heard of DevExpress. Just give us a quick background, catch us up on the last couple of years. What's been going on in your world and in DevExpress? And I think you moved to a new continent, you know, small stuff like that.
Okay. Well, I am in, we'll start with the continent. I'm living in Valencia, Spain right now. In general, I really love it. I don't speak Spanish so very much at all. So I'm, you know, totally failing on the communication side of things, watching my wife and kids, you know, become masters at Spanish before my eyes, you know, so I'm proud of those guys. I'm biking the kids into school every day and picking them up on the bike and they're biking back. And we did this last year and we started this year. And last year they had really heavy bikes, you know, the, mm-hmm. you know, not, you know, cheap. They were cheap bikes and they were heavy. And this year I got them, since he did so well last year, I got him lighter weight bikes. And these kids are now going ahead of me and I'm trying to catch up with these kids. But in general, I'm loving it. The Valencia is, they take really good care of their parks and like their sidewalks. Like I see sidewalk cleaning machines and sidewalk sweepers weekly outside, right? And that's not, they'll take care of the roads too, but the sidewalks, they take care of that, take care of the parks, they invest money in the parks. So in general, it's pretty nice here. I really like it.
Nice.
As far as DevExpress goes, you know, we're still pushing hard on CodeRush. We just in the last, I think, 2 months, we just released it for free, and we made it free for everyone, and we're excited wow. about that. And it is, you can download it. All you have to do is register it, and it's, you've got a permanent copy of CodeRush running there. If you want to get tech support, you can of course pay for a pro version that includes tech support, but you don't need to do that at all because you can get community support and you can still report bugs, things like that. So we're excited about that because, you know, we think we've been working hard on it. I've been working on CodeRush since I want to say 1999, 2000, somewhere in that time frame, I think. So CodeRush first for Delphi, and then in about 2003, we switched over to CodeRush for Visual Studio, as I recall. And we did the port there. But I've been, you know, I've been doing developer tools, you know, like I think we passed the four decades, you know. I know in the bio it says almost four. I think we've passed the four decades. And I'm like on my, starting my fifth decade of just doing tools to make developers faster. It's, you know, something I love to do. So.
Yeah. And you have a really long, long tenure at DevExpress, just doing all those developer tools.
That's true. I was, you know, when I was like, wait, because I joined around the time we switched over to Visual Studio. So I had my own company prior to that. And then we brought that into DevExpress. And that was around 2003, I think 2002, 2003. 2003 is when we released CodeRush for Visual Studio, the first version of it. And so, yeah, it's like we're at about two decades at DevExpress that I've been working. And like I say, it's really fun in general. It's really, really fun to be able to say, oh, I've got an idea for something faster or something that's going to help me think less, spend less time thinking while I'm writing code, that sort of thing. And then to build it, right? To manifest it, make it, you know, create it, because then I get to use it for, you know, creating the next thing, right?
Yeah.
I've always kind of likened this a little bit to modifying the car while you're in the race, while you're driving, right?
But you have another copy of your car.
That's true. We have We do. I had, when we were in Delphi, by the way, I had the edit compile test cycle so streamlined. All I had to do was make a change to the plugin and rebuild it. And it would automatically, since it was being built, it would unload it. And when the build was finished, it would reload it right back into the same environment. I didn't even have to start a separate EXE because I'm testing in the IDE. Mm-hmm. And it was insane. I loved it. It was like, let's try this. Oh, that's not it. Let's try this. Let's just, you know, you could just, you know, make iterative edit compile test changes. Really enjoyed that. Visual Studio is harder to do that in. So what I do with Visual Studio is I create kind of a standalone app that I'm working on that I build the pieces in and test them in. And then I also incorporate those in. And so I will do the build. For me right now, a build the build takes less than about a minute. But the install takes about a minute and a half to two. And that's because I'm waiting on Visual Studio. I have to unload the old V6 and then bring in the new V6 file. And that's generally about, like I say, about 90 seconds to about 2 minutes. So because of that delay, I'm not able to do that kind of really nice, sweet, iterative, you know, design that I like, but, you know, it is what it is. We make it, you know, make it work and sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, Visual Studio, I'm on that bandwagon as I love using really, really good IDEs, and Visual Studio and all its different versions over the last several decades has been great. But you're a proponent of installing an add-in into the IDE that Microsoft provides and making the statement, you know, it's going to be better this way. There's plenty of listeners out there that maybe they've never even looked at add-ons, or they've never tried them and they don't know even what's available. Can you share, what is your current thought process on that? The people who would say, oh, I'm using Visual Studio. It's for Microsoft. It's great. What am I missing?
Oh, what's the sales pitch there, I guess, right? So that's a great question.
Philosophy, you could pitch a particular product, but the philosophy of saying, no, you want to add stuff into Visual Studio. Don't just use it vanilla.
Yeah, no, I'm actually, you know, I'm kind of, you know, friendly to both sides of the argument, you know. In other words, if people are like, if someone says, I don't need to write code faster, I don't need to spend less effort, I'm comfortable with the speed and, you know, the speed at which I write. Or alternatively, if they say, well, I'm not rushing to write code. I'm not trying to get code out of my mind. I am actually writing a few lines of code every few minutes. Right. I have a slow, methodical approach and I like that. If that's you, then yeah, you're fine. You're really, really good where you are. Right. That's it. But for me, CodeRush has always started because I had ideas that I couldn't express fast enough and I couldn't get them out. I just couldn't get them out fast enough. Mm-hmm. Right. I also, I'm a big fan of teaching, right? I'm a big fan of kind of a pedagogical approach to code, where and an example approach to code, where somebody asks a question and we say, well, let's go ahead and try that now, right? And so in those scenarios where someone is saying, you know, is changing the spec live while you're sitting down mm-hmm. at the keyboard, right? Being able to very quickly change the architecture, very quickly create the architecture, there are advantages to that, for me at least. I'm excited by those. But it's kind of also, though, Jeffrey, it's a lot like if you don't know, right? If you've never tried it, right, you're going to be fine and happy for the rest of your life. Because it's only if you've experienced, you know, driving in like the most amazing car possible, mm-hmm. and then you go back to a less than that you start missing it.
Yeah.
Right. It's that kind of a thing. There's another component that is that you benefit from products like CodeRush, even if you don't use them. And the reason you do is because products like CodeRush typically are the leaders in innovating new features that are often incorporated into the IDE. So there are a number of IDE innovations, Visual Studio and others across, and in others as well, other IDEs as well, that started with tools like CodeRush, right? That mm-hmm. were innovated there and later were essentially implemented by the host environment.
That's a good point. You know, what is it? Control comma for searching across every file in the whole solution and every method name. That sure. wasn't always in Visual Studio.
Right.
And it was painful.
Well, you see that. And that's the thing, right? It's painful without it once you've tried it. Once you've had something that gets you there. I'll tell you, there's one feature in Visual Studio I really like, and I'm forgetting the name of it already. I should totally know this, but it's like CodeSense is what I think it is, but it's the artificial intelligence driven
IntelliCode.
Yeah, IntelliCode. Is that what it is?
Type ahead. Yeah, if you copy and paste it a few times, it says, "Oh, would you like this snippet of code?"
Yeah, IntelliCode is a brilliant innovation. It's a brilliant, and you know, from my perspective, that didn't really start with a third party, you know, add-in. Mm-hmm. There was CodePilot over at GitHub, as I recall, was out around the same time. But so you were seeing, you know, R&D, you know, teams kind of pushing up this technology. But that's one that did not come with CodeRush first. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that. We did not invent that first. That is and I continue to be impressed with this feature. I want to remind everybody, it's in the 1.0 stage, right? This is the first release of this feature. This feature is likely to get better. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to invest in it, and it's going to get, I think it has the potential to get really, really, really good. And so I'm looking forward to that. You know, what is Visual Studio going to do to bring that out? But CodeRush is, you know, CodeRush started too. You know, the thing is that I kind of want to reverse your question, right? Instead of asking the question about the mindset of the person of, you know, whether I install something or not, let's talk about what kind of mindset it takes to decide I'm going to create a business model on always trying to be better than Microsoft. At developer tools, right?
Yeah.
Then what kind of crazy does it take to be in the room on that to have everybody sign off and get started on that? Right.
Well, hey, it's worked. I mean, and Microsoft can't do everything. I mean, it's not just DevExpress. It's other companies that have all these components for WinForms and ASP.NET and now MAUI. I mean, I look for Blazor. I look forward to see what people are going to come out with MAUI, because I can imagine this future where we're slinging smartphone applications. You know, we have an idea in the morning and we got a smartphone app in the evening.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot there.
So with Visual Studio being so good and you know, it's hard, but obviously possible to compete with it, what is your thinking on VS Code? And what do you personally use? Because, you know, we see both of them are out there and both of them get a lot of play, but what's the Mark philosophy on that?
Well, I like a lot of the plugins that are available for VS Code. I'll start by saying that. I think that their architecture is beautifully, wonderfully simple. But it's also missing some things that I want for to be able to create really beautiful things. And I've had trouble getting the team to be on board with suggestions I've made to do that. And so we have put out a couple free plugins in that space to just see what, test the waters and see what, you know, see what the reaction would be. And ultimately we kind of measured the reaction as kind of like, you know what, it's not feeling right. And because we don't have a way to create, like I said, we can't create really, really beautiful UI. Mm-hmm. We're really limited on what we can do in that space. And because of that, we're like, and we've got this already, we've got CodeRush, like I say, for Visual Studio Desktop. We've got a lot of code there and a lot of investment there, right? We've got a lot of customers who are still using that, still producing code, that sort of thing. And who are like, you know, if they try to move over to VS Code, they have some trouble there because the CodeRush features aren't there that they're mm-hmm. dependent on or needing. So there's some sort of compromise in that space going across. So I use Visual Studio to develop. Is what I use. I have spent a little bit of time in VS Code and I've spent a little bit of time watching other people use it as well. Mm-hmm. You know, like I say, I think it's lean and fast and I do like those aspects of the design, but I would love for there to be, I'd love for there to be a sense of kind of a greater cooperation between the team, but that wasn't the case. I was like, hey, can you guys do this? And they're like, we want you to go put an issue out and get this many votes mm-hmm. and then we'll consider it. So we put the issue out and we got, you know, we met the threshold. And after we met the threshold, they said, we're not going to do it. And I'm like, well, wait, I thought the threshold was just to get the votes.
They didn't mean it.
And, yeah. And so I was like, you know, you leave that experience. So compare that experience with an experience I had with Dustin Campbell back when he worked for DevExpress, and Dustin Campbell and I are at Microsoft and we have a meeting that they brought us into, and they're like, we don't really understand what the meeting's about yet going in. And at the start of the meeting, they're like, what do you need from us? What features do you want to make your product better? And I was just stunned at the question. And I was like, are you serious? You're asking me right now? Because usually it's, I want this, and I usually have to push hard to get it, right? Mm-hmm. I want this feature, whatever it is. And I have to make a case. I have to say, look, it won't cost you anything. It's going to be low risk because I'm the only one who's going to use it mm-hmm. or whatever, but I need this piece in right here. So we're in that meeting and I said, I want variable line height. I want to be able to specify the height of an individual line. Mm. So that's what I want. And they're like, why? Because I want to do embedded images. And I want to be able to drop an image into the source code and resize it, crop it, make it feel look just like I dropped it into Outlook or any other, you know, any other thing that I can drop images in. And they were like, they thought about it for a second and they gave it to me. And that feature is actually used by other features in Visual Studio, like CodeLens, for example. So they gave me the feature. They started using the feature. In fact, before I actually brought in embedded imaging, because there were other problems I had to solve that I was still working through in my mind and how to get all of those problems solved. But embedded images is like one of the features I'm most proud of from a standpoint of beauty in terms of an elegance of design and intuition. It just feels right, that sort of thing. So I really like the work that we did there in that space, and that was made possible by the team. But that is not the relationship I have with the VS Code team. And I, you know, I'm okay with that, right? I accept that. I'm like, okay, I can accept that because you have a ton of people making plugins for that. Mm-hmm. And so if you go in and you try, if we were to try to do the same thing and create a CodeRush for VS Code,
yeah,
it would be horrendously competitive because any one feature we do, somebody else would just be spending day and night on making a better version of that. And that would be free. And, you know, there's no way we could create really a business model in that space that I see. Mm-hmm. I don't see a business model there.
Yeah,
I don't. You know, maybe we can do tools, but right now we are tightly focused on CodeRush for Visual Studio and extending that feature, that functionality and offshoots from that technology. That's where we are right now.
Yeah. That seems to be a common response with .NET developers is that, okay, we got VS Code and that's great, but for the big serious development, well, we're in full Visual Studio, and I as well, because you get everything when you need to run the full application, which probably has a couple of processes, you know, a little bit of back-end jobs going on. But, you know, my text editor of choice is VS Code. If I need to quickly open a PowerShell file or whatever, oh, open it or smaller things.
Right.
VS Code is great. I can appreciate the strategy, too, with Azure wanting to host everything. You know, Azure wants to be the hosting provider for every application. And you got, you know, a lot of other platforms that are not .NET. And hey, VS Code has done a great job of pulling those over.
Yeah.
But
yeah, no, I think the architecture on it is, the architecture is great. It's just not a place for me right now. That's the only thing.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery. Clear Measure is also happy to be a sponsor of the video podcast, Programming with Palermo. Watch, learn, and program alongside Chief Architect Jeffrey Palermo. Videos are added weekly and available on syndicated locations supporting video podcast or by visiting palermo.network. Tune in today.
I like asking this question because for the listeners, you know, should I be using it? I'm not using it. Am I missing out? And I keep on coming. Look, if you're doing .NET development, no, you're not missing out. Stick with Visual Studio. Your life is great.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. I also think, by the way, I think the key to winning long term in the IDE world, the IDE, you know, whether or the editor world, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. I think the key long term is really finding the innovative features that kind of have built in discoverability, built in, you know, immediate understanding of what the feature is suggesting or offering, and really nailing the quality of that suggestion, mm-hmm. right? I think that we're looking in, and it could be quality of suggestion or really nailing the presentation of the information so that you can look at it and you can just use less brain power to get to the same place you had to use more brain power before you had the feature, right? Mm-hmm. So you're just like, okay, I immediately see it. Oh, I get it. Beautifully done. I understand this diagram, or I understand, you know, this layout. I think that's the key, right? I really do. I think that the IntelliCode feature we're talking about it's a step in that direction, right? It's pushing mm-hmm. in that space. And I also think that I don't know anything that's happening inside Microsoft, but I think that it is in Microsoft's best interest to have the Visual Studio team and the VS Code team working together mm-hmm. to find these gems, right? To find these secrets, these secret gems to help developers get to from point A to point B with fewer keystrokes, with less shifting of the eyes, without moving your eyes so much, right? Fewer mouse clicks, less thought, all of that. And I think that that's the key. Right. If they can stay ahead of everybody else in those spaces, they continue to amass a giant user base and they are able to fend off competitors mm-hmm. effectively. I think that's the key. I don't really see it in you know, the kind of Azure approach where you're just throwing everything, you know, hosting everything. I think it's more along the lines of finding that fast, narrow path that's comfortable and familiar. I feel like that's where the real gains in customer numbers in are going to occur. That's where I think it's going to be.
Yeah, that's interesting because for a long time, so many product teams at Microsoft, and still do, try not to be opinionated because they want to make sure that there's an offering for every customer and want to give options. And even, you know, the documentation, it's rare that you find documentation that says, okay, this is how you should think about it and just do it this way. Instead, it's, if you want to do this, then this API is appropriate. If you want to do this.
Right.
And it was like, tell me how I should decide what I want to do.
Yeah, I usually go to Stack Overflow for discussions on best practices. Mm-hmm. Right? Microsoft generally sees out of that space, but Stack Overflow enters that space with abandon.
Yeah. Right? Well, the people on Stack Overflow.
Right. That's what I mean. That's what I meant to say. Sure.
Yeah, not Stack Overflow corporate.
Right, of course.
But that's,
of course.
So with developing an add-in like this and design, your thought process of minimizing the keystrokes and the tracking of the eye, that seems like that mindset is perfectly transferable to even application UI design for end user applications, right?
It is.
So with the developers out there, what are the big ideas that have stayed with you over your career that they really need to be aware of? I think of something that I think we've lost. We all hate the crusty, if we have a client that comes along and says, here's my COBOL code, because they still have a crusty green screen application that runs on one computer and they can't find a replacement if it were to ever go down, that one mainframe. But yet you watch the users just jamming out the function keys and the keyboard, and they're getting stuff done and they're checking people out, or all these car mechanic places that still use the green screen. And then you go to somewhere that's using a mouse to use some Windows, or shoot, an iPad application to try to get your order at a restaurant. You're like, man, why are you taking so long?
I'm sorry. So no, I'm going to just take that as a statement right now. I don't quite sure there's a question in there. Well, you asked what the big ideas, right?
Yeah.
What are the big ideas?
Then I started lamenting about what I see. So for application developers who are trying to make a beautiful UI that does make their users productive, what's like the big idea that stuck with you throughout your career that they should know about?
I don't think I have a great single answer to that. I got like about 14 answers to that, but I'm going to prioritize. And I guess I'll say the biggest one is discoverability, I think. In other words, you want it to be easy for your customers to discover how to use the app, what features are in the app. Those two things: what's in the app, what features have you written that I can use as a user, and how do I use those? Mm-hmm. So sometimes you can get discoverability. One example of a real easy way to do discoverability, if you have a dialogue and they're interacting with it, if some things aren't appropriate for whatever options they've chosen, you can gray those out. For example, you just disable them, right? So super simple way to do discoverability. Another simple way is with tooltips, right? I hover over something and some information is there. Another way to do discoverability is to make something in a familiar interface to something they've already seen. So for example, I just recently created a media player and I based it on designs that I looked at on YouTube, because YouTube is, a pretty widely used media player.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I looked very carefully at their UI, including what happens on the icons as I hover over, when I click them, all of that. And I basically said, okay, let's model and then let's find areas where we can improve and make it better. So I'm able to do that because of my sense of research and understanding of what's going on. So I can say, okay, here's where we can make it a little bit better. And so I did it. I built a media player that looks like it was done by pros and it's good. And I get the discoverability because it's familiar. Mm-hmm. Right. I look at it and I see, a play button. I've seen play buttons before. I know what to do. For example, I see a bar across the top that's part red on the left, and on the right it's gray, and there's a round red circle in the middle, and I can click and drag that, and that's my track bar to show me positioning, right? Because I've seen that before. Mm-hmm. So familiarity is another way that you can do discoverability. So discoverability is my first answer, but in terms of that's just good because it has so many benefits. Mm-hmm. It has so many benefits. It can help people get up to speed faster. Once they understand, it doesn't help them execute faster, right? To answer that question, like productivity, there's a different answer there. But discoverability is one of those. I'm going to jump kind of slightly off of productivity, and I'm going to say my number two is contrast with text. Okay. So we read text on the black and white spectrum, okay? So that means if I have red text on a dark blue background or on a blue background, it's essentially gray on gray, right? And so we don't process on color. It's very hard to read. So a lot of times people will throw the background, well, they'll do color in the background or a pattern in the background. Mm-hmm. And that is not recommended. Office even did this, I think, in 2005, as I recall. They had one of the last step of the install is choose your funky background for Office. Do you remember this? And you would have, you could have like an underwater kind of design, and all these different themes, and they would throw it on there. And I would went insane when I saw it because
undo.
It was getting top billing, right? It was part of the install. So every single person who installed saw that question. It was getting top billing. It was absolutely wrong. It was taking the background, which is low importance, right? You don't click on the background for anything. And it was representing it in a way that was higher importance. So from a standpoint of contrast, it was wrong. The background needs to be clean, no saturation in it. And the text needs to be, for WCAG guidelines, 2.0 guidelines, it's got to have a contrast ratio of 7:1 at least against the background, which means we're talking about, if it's a white background, we're talking about something darker than medium gray. Mm-hmm. We're talking about at least in that space for it to be easily read. And I find that many products, like probably, I'd just thrown out a number here, I'd probably say, I'd say probably about 100,000 products based on estimates make this mistake where they at some point have low contrast text that's hard to read. And these can be physical products. For example, I've got a set of Yahtzee dice that are brown with black spots on the dark brown dice. And it's insane. Yeah. It's insane. Yeah. Everybody's in low light. You can't even play Yahtzee with this dice, right? For example. So it's from physical products to software. And so contrast, you want to make sure the text is easy to read, that it passes the WCAG 2.0 guidelines. That's like my second one that I want to throw out there. The third one, I guess I'll throw, is I guess I'm going to call this the bang for the buck approach. And this is the same thing we do with, like, you know, triage and fixing bugs, right? Or even feature development, right? What can we get that's the biggest gain with the least amount of effort, right? So number one is discoverability. I'm just reviewing. Number two is contrast. And number three is you want to scan your app or your website and look at what are your critical, most important paths. You're trying to get people to register or sign up? That's an important path. You're trying to sell something? That's an important path, right? So you find your important paths where you can get your biggest bang for the buck. And you look at those and you ask yourself the question, can I get there with less effort? Can I get there with moving my mouse less? Mm-hmm. Can I get there with clicking fewer times? Can I get there with shifting my gaze, moving my eyes, you know, not so far? And you do that. And if you don't believe me, you do A-B testing on it, right? You do it and you get your A-B testing set up, so you get your verification. By the way, one of the things that's remarkable is I actually see with sites that can do A-B testing, I see improvements in UI design that are happening, that are, the evidence seems to be they're happening not because somebody knows what they're doing. It's because the A-B testing is saying, this is what's winning.
Yeah.
Right? It's kind of remarkable, right? Right? You just get to a point where you're like, oh, we understand great UI because our A-B testing has taught us what is working.
Yeah, right? That's good.
I'm going to say number four. I'm going to throw a fourth one at you.
All right.
And that's parallel paths. So give me more than one way to accomplish something. And the simplest example of this is if you go to Amazon and you try to place an order, your buy now button is in two places on the page. Mm-hmm. It's at the top and it's at the bottom, right? So you've given me parallel paths, two ways to get it. You're not forcing me to scroll up, because if you force a million people to scroll up to hit that button, you're going to lose some sales.
Yeah.
Right? That's going to cost you. Right. So, yeah, that's like, I'll throw that out as number four, and and that'll be my short answer to your question. How's that sound?
Well, these are good. I can see some of the listeners furiously taking notes and rewinding, because this is information that you would say, oh, this isn't new. I've been thinking about this stuff for years, and there's been lots of people arguing about it. But I keep being reminded, our industry has grown so much. There's a massive number of people who, you know, need to learn a bunch of stuff. Doesn't matter if it's an old conversation, the dust still hasn't settled, and we as an industry still haven't universally gotten good at all this stuff.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I'm buying major products from big companies that are still having problems, right? There's still like, there's provably wrong elements to either the UI, the user interface, or the packaging or the hardware, you know, or the physical part of packaging, something along those lines as you're opening up or something, you know, in that space. I recently bought a HyperVolt Go. It's a massager. It's actually incredibly well made, right? Really well designed. But to turn it on, you have to hold down the power button for about, they say in the manual, about 2 seconds, and I find it's closer to 3. And it drives me nuts, Jeffrey. I go crazy, right? I'm holding this down because I go crazy because, one, I know it's wrong. Two, to hold the button down, it requires more force than to just click it, right? Because you have to ensure that it stays in the down position. Yeah. Whereas a click, you need less force, right? Mm-hmm. So the force is excessive. The time is excessive. It's everything is wrong. The design, the mechanics of it are amazing. I think they're using electromagnetics inside, so that it, like, you can get that thing to stop and there's no motor humming. You know, you can put so much force on it that it stops moving and there's no hum, there's no smoke, nothing. This thing is really well designed. It's got a pretty good charge, but they've totally blown the turn on of it.
Yeah.
But they've fixed it in a later higher end model, apparently. Yeah. Yeah, but it's like, but this is regularly happening, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing is, it's like I look at this stuff and I'm like, this is so easy to fix, right? Yep. Now, on the one hand, your only argument, by the way, for such a bizarre setup is so that, like, if I was going to pack this in my luggage, I wouldn't want it to accidentally turn on. That's the only argument that you can make for such a ridiculous way to turn this thing on, right? Yeah. But that's it. And you could still roll that time back to a second and you'd still be in better shape, right?
Or just make it a slider or some other type of switch.
Sure. Put a different switch on there. You can afford it.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah. So like, you know, that's one example, but every day I'm finding something, I'm looking at something, I'm like, okay, this shouldn't be this way. Yeah. And the thing is, if you don't have a critical path, if you don't have a critical path where you can do A/B testing, a lot of times you won't know, and you'll, you know, or later, and you'll create a regression where things are harder to use in a more recent version of the software, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, yeah, we can talk about this, and there's still a lot for a lot of people to learn. I think there really is. I think that this is, by the way, this is like something that I've actually taught to kids. The science of good design, right? And it's kind of interesting to teach it to young people, right? Because young people actually do have to do design. They have to create reports, you know, and labs and things like that in school, right, as they go through. And the thing is, nobody talks about it ever because, you know, it's not something that's widely discussed. And I thought, this is actually a really interesting idea to have part of a core curriculum for children because you end up having everybody understand as they go out into the world, right? And then overall, the design of everything is improved in the next generation.
Some people have said, don't annoy your users with your design. Well, if you don't annoy your teachers, you might get a better grade. they have to hunt for where your information
is. Right. I recently put in a visa application so I could get my Spanish visa. And the instructions are detailed and vague, ambiguous, detailed and ambiguous. And I ended up creating a document that was about almost 200 pages long by the time for all four of the family members that included all the necessary documents, all the translations of the documents, all the copies of everything, right? Everything that was required. Ooh. And this comes from about a page of instruction that says you need these 7 items, essentially is what you need. But you need to prove different things. You need to prove that you're not a criminal. You need to prove that you have money and you're not going to, you know, be problematic. You can prove you have health insurance, all of these things. But there's not a lot of guidelines. And what I ended up doing is I put myself in the mindset of the visa reviewer. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are they going to need to know? And so I created like a very visual table of contents on the first page. And that table of contents lined up with tabs out there. So there was color coded. The color had meaning. They went to the tabs. They could pull on the tab and go to it. And they'd be right at that section, whatever the piece is. So on the first page, you know, because you've got all these different requirements and mm-hmm. there are four of us. And then you open it up and then you get there and then you start flipping through and say, for example, they wanted copies. So one of the requirements is copies of every single page of your passports. And so what okay. I did is I sorted by person, right? Me first, my wife, then basically by age yep. is what I did. Okay. And in addition to that, I put a sticker on each. I put the photocopies inside transparent sleeves, put a sticker on the sleeve for which the name of the person it was. Right, for each of those. Mm-hmm. And I repeated that same strategy so it would be a familiar pattern to them for each of the 11 sections that I had to do. So they could go through and they could immediately see, okay, this is for Mark Miller, you know, this is for Karen, whatever, mm-hmm. this is for the kids, that sort of thing. And so, and at the end, I thought, this is really well designed. I still might get denied,
right?
You know, for something, because like I say, they're detailed but ambiguous. I could have done like, I think one of five or six things wrong that mm-hmm. I could get rejected for. But it's similar to a report that somebody has to do, right? If you're working on a report that you have to give to somebody, right? Making it easier to read and understand the critical, most important information, making it easier to navigate your data, right? That work is the same whether you're creating something physical like my visa application or a report, or if you're creating a way to see or visualize data that the company has access to, the company's data, mm-hmm. right? Whatever that is, right? Visualization, right? Helping people see and understand the most important parts, right? Giving thought to those things, I think it's a good thing to do.
So with these thought processes, it seems like it's not even just software or a particular area, but it's a whole mindset that can be applied in a lot of different places, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the thing. Basically, what we're talking about, Jeffrey, is communication from one biological entity or from the software or the hardware to the biological entity, mm-hmm. right? That's what we're talking about, communication to a human being. And whether it's a mouse, whether it's a package I'm opening up, whether I'm going through a door, whether I'm hitting an elevator button, whether I'm creating a report for somebody, it's all about communication. And so if you understand how humans perceive their world and understand their world, you can derive from this guidelines that are essentially based on the human biology. And it applies to everything, right? Good design applies to everything. And this idea, the science of good design applies to everything as well. I was talking to my wife about interior design. Mm-hmm. And and I had this kind of little small mini epiphany where I was like, oh, there's texture and there's light and there's three dimensions that we're working with here, mm-hmm. right? And there's this idea, one of the design patterns of interior design is an anchor, an anchoring piece to bring to call your attention to, mm-hmm. okay. right? And then you have supporting pieces around. And we're talking about playing with light. Like the anchoring piece can be big or it can be small, but high contrast, for example, right? You can shine a lot of light on it, for example. And this introductory theme of getting your eyes on something and drawing you in. You see that again and again. You see it in architecture, for example, as well, mm-hmm. right? We open it, we go through a narrow corridor into a wide open character corridor, and there's something at the end, mm. right? If you look at some of the old churches here in Europe, it's that kind of feeling, right? Mm-hmm. As you go inside and that three-dimensional experience. Now we don't have the three-dimensional experience in the software, but you know, the other pieces are certainly there. So yeah, it applies across the board to every single thing. Anything you touch, anything you read, anything you experience is essentially a communication, right? And mm-hmm. so we're always looking at what's the best, most efficient way to communicate the important information to the people.
Yeah. Well, at least one listener's mind is blown. That's for sure. Because if listeners, if you haven't really dove into this and read up on it, yeah, it's a lot there. It's a whole mindset. But man, thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing with us about this. This is one of those timeless topics that, you know, developers need to be good at, but it's timeless. It's not going to go out of style. It's not going to go away. So yeah, thanks so much.
No, you're right. Hey, you're welcome. My pleasure. Awesome. Hey, can I say hi to everybody?
Absolutely.
Hey,
kids. Go ahead. Hi from Spain.
Hi, I'm from Spain, everybody. It's me, your buddy.
Awesome. Well, listeners, until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.